From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a call to change the way we talk about, define early cancer. But the number of full-on invasive cancer cases keeps rising. Richard Nixon launched what came to be called the War on Cancer in 1971. This year, 2013, some 600,000 Americans will die of cancer. We walk for the cure and ride for the cure and race for the cure. So where's the cure? This hour on Point, the War on Cancer, why we're not closer to a cure already, and where the promising research is now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are we going at this the right way, the search for a cure? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear later in this hour from a writer who says we've lost our way on cancer and from a big research chief who says he sees progress and promise. But first, joining me now from New York to discuss the new recommendation to remove the word cancer from some diagnoses is Dr. Jonathan LaPook, chief medical correspondent for the CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley. He's also a clinical professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Jonathan LaPook, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Why this recommendation to change the way doctors talk with patients about some kinds of cancer?
Well, there's no doubt that screening for cancer has saved a lot of lives. The problem is, with all these testings that we're doing, all the tests that we're doing, you pick up a lot of abnormalities that turn out that they're never going to hurt the person. And yet we go ahead and do all sorts of testing and procedures on them. And so what they're saying is, for example, they give an example of breast cancer. There's a type of breast cancer biopsy abnormality called DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, stage zero cancer. Breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, this is something that if just left alone like that, it doesn't harm a woman. But sometimes it goes on to invasive breast cancer, sometimes it doesn't. And
right.
They're saying, let's get rid of the word carcinoma. And another example is with a kind of abnormal prostate biopsy called high-grade PIN, which is a kind of a neoplasia or abnormal tissue growth.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can be a precursor to prostate cancer. But even if you do go on to get prostate cancer, most people who get prostate cancer don't die from it. So they're saying, get rid of the word neoplasia. They're saying, look, these words are scary, carcinoma, neoplasia, cancer, and they make people, you know, so worried that when the doctor says to them, you've got this in them, they immediately have a knee-jerk reflex and say, let's get it out, let's do a lot of testing, a lot of procedures. And they're saying, you know, sometimes maybe you're going to be aggressive, maybe you're going to do treatment or some middle treatment, or maybe, just maybe the doctor may say to you, you know something? We're not quite sure what to do. Let's just wait and see.
But this is about language, right? I mean, in interacting with a patient. So what are we going to call them? I mean, jelly beans, pixie sticks. What will they say?
I know. My first reaction when I saw this was, my knee-jerk reaction was a rose by any other name. I mean, you're calling it something else. But, you know, I was on the phone with Laura Esserman, who was one of the authors of the article, and she pointed out that these words are so charged
mm-hmm.
that sometimes they don't allow you to have sort of rational thinking when you hear it. You just want to get it out. But, you know, we're seeing over the years, everybody, you know, you've heard about evidence-based medicine and people sort of taking stock and saying, what is really the evidence that doing all this testing helps? And, you know, the United States Preventive Services Task Force came out with a recommendation in May of 2012 against doing this routine screening PSA, which is a blood test that looks for something that when it gets high can suggest that there's prostate cancer, but there are a lot of other causes of it being high. And they point out that for every 1,000 men who were screened, one man at most avoids death from prostate cancer, but for those 30, for 1,000 men who are screened, 30 to 40 get erectile dysfunction or urinary incontinence
yeah.
due to
yeah.
treatment. Two men get a serious cardiovascular event such as a heart attack from treatment.
Yep.
One man will get a serious blood clot from the treatment. And for every 3,000 who are screened, one man will die from complications from surgical treatment. So, you know, there's a lot of people sort of looking at this stuff and saying, what price glory and what should we do? Now, I'm a gastroenterologist, okay?
Yes.
So I do screening colonoscopies, and that's an example. Of course, I'm a little biased, where
mm-hmm.
you're finding a polyp, which is pre-malignant. It's not yet cancer. And so plucking it out prevents that person from getting cancer. And I think that there's no question that the benefits outweigh the risks.
So,
what's the
recommendation here, then? You know, when the doctor sits with the patient, that to say, well, this could go to cancer, or not even to use the word? And can you just leave the patient in the dark about that possibility?
Well, you know, I know that people always want to take a brick and throw it through the television set when they say, you know, consult your doctor and each person has to be individualized.
Yeah.
But this is really all about personalized medicine, and the one size does not fit all. And you really have to be able to be willing as a doctor to take the time. And by the way, you know, there's not enough time these days, I think, that we give to our patients to sit through, to go through all this complicated thinking and the algorithms and explain to them what the risks and benefits are. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of emotion here. After we did this story, I spoke to some breast cancer surgeon who was very adamant that, you know, you want to do treatment of DCIS. You want to certainly do a lumpectomy, she said, and you want to do probably some other treatment, and you don't want to leave people with the idea that you don't do anything. And you find there's always friction when intuition and emotion rub up against evidence-based medicine, this new thing, evidence-based medicine. I actually think there's a role for all three. I do believe in the role of intuition and the hair standing up in the back of your neck. And, you know, that means something to me, having been a doctor for 33 years. I mean, I know why the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up, but I pay attention to them. So, you know, we have this trend right now to go towards evidence-based medicine, and certainly I agree with it. You should look at all the pros and cons and the statistics. I do also believe in intuition, and I also do believe that you need to listen to patients. I mean, just yesterday, you know, the U.S. Preventive Task Force says that they recommend against teaching women to do self-breast exam, but I can tell you that last week, one of my patients said she felt a lump, and I saw her the next day. I sent her for a biopsy, and yesterday I told her that she has breast cancer. But it's so early, so incredibly early, really just a tiny little thing, that her prognosis is excellent. You are never going to tell this woman, who is my patient, that she should not have done self-exam.
It all gets our attention in a hurry. Recommendation this week to rein in the language, the alarm, a little bit. Dr. Jonathan Lepook with CBS Evening News, it's so good of you to join us. Thank you very much for a few minutes of your time today.
Nice talking to you, Tom.
So where are we, big picture, on cancer? This was 1971, the President's State of the Union Address, Richard Nixon, talking about defeating cancer. The effort became known as the War on Cancer.
I will also ask for an appropriation of an extra $100 million to launch an intensive campaign to find a cure for cancer, and I will ask later for whatever additional funds can effectively be used. The time has come in America, when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
Here we are. It's 2013. Where are we on this dread disease? With me now from New York is Clifton Leaf, contributing editor at Fortune magazine. He was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, cancer of the lymph system, at age 15. He survived. His mother died from cancer at age 57. He served on the board of directors of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation. His new book is The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Clifton Leaf, thank you very much for joining us. What do you mean we're losing the war on cancer?
Well, thanks, Tom. I think you have to reframe the question as from looking for cures to what the burden of cancer is. And so part of that burden, as Dr. Lepook had mentioned up top, is, you know, we've got all these people getting cancer or being diagnosed with cancer, and there's a treatment associated with that. So we have, as you mentioned, nearly 600,000 Americans dying of cancer each year. What we have, 1.7 million Americans being diagnosed with cancer. And that number has gone up about three times faster than the population since we began this war. And there's a burden associated with that.
When you say burden, you mean what? Literally the burden of treatment and so on, or just the incidence? What do you mean by the burden?
It's the treatment, it's the cost of that treatment, it's the lost work, the wages, the everything associated, the emotional, spiritual burden of being diagnosed with cancer. So it comes with a lot of baggage, and we all, you know, anyone who's ever heard that diagnosis carries it, whether they're called cured or not, they carry it for the rest of their lives.
So you say don't think first necessarily about a cure, but you say we're losing the war for what then?
So we're losing the war because the burden of cancer has gone up every way you can measure it. So as you say, the number of people who are dying is close to 600,000. That number, the raw number, is going up year after year. The number of people getting it is going up, what we're spending on this war. So it's becoming it's more of a threat to the nation, to our public health, than it was when President Nixon declared that war on this disease.
That's kind of incredible. Sounds like we could use a cure in that case. But what are you pushing for in the war on cancer then?
Well, part of that comes, interestingly enough, in relation to the news today. So how do you reduce the burden? Well, first thing you do, people aren't going to die of cancer unless they get it. So the easiest way to prevent them from dying is to prevent them from getting it, or to intercept the disease, intervene in the disease early in its progression. And so part of what this news that Dr. LaPook was talking about is this redefining of cancer and what these early pre-malignant lesions are, whether they're cancer or not cancer, and what we should call them. And so that brings us to the question of whether cancer really is a state or an event, like so many people think of it as, or if it's a process, which it really is. And that's where we have to redefine. That's where our frame shift has to come.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about where we are in tackling cancer with a reporter who says the effort has kind of stalled out, gone awry, and a big research chief who says, no, we're on it. Behind us right there, supporters cheering on walkers in the Avon Breast Cancer Walk in New York City last year. And here, an appeal for funds for the American Cancer Society. This is Mary J. Blige.
Listen up. Each year, hundreds of promising research studies go unfunded for breast cancer, for lung cancer, every cancer. The American Cancer Society has been behind nearly every breakthrough in recent history. But there's still more work to do. So let's make sure that no research is silenced. Let's make noise. Let's make noise. Yeah. And let's finish the fight.
Let's finish the fight, says Mary J. Blige. We're going to hear in a few minutes from the president of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. But with me right now from New York is Clifton Leaf. He's author of the new book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. There's an excerpt at our website. Cliff, talk about this losing. What are the dynamics that you see as losing? You talk about a bureaucratization, some problems with the profit motive, as I read you. What's the problem?
Well, I think that the problem is that the systems are all designed to get researchers not to collaborate, to hoard their data rather than share it, to think small rather than big. And so we've actually built those systems in. We built them 40 plus years ago. And so the more money that we throw into this, the less that actually goes to truly novel projects. And I'm not kidding. It really is the less. It was actually easier to come up with an innovative idea and pursue it for an independent scientist 20, 30 years ago than it is today.
What's wrong with the research? You say it's not making big leaps because, what, it's too incremental? People aren't sharing the data sufficiently? Is that where you're going?
Part of it is that, and part of it is just the thinking. There's the way the money is doled out is through a process called peer review and study sections. These are groups of elders who come and look at what a research proposal, you know, purports to do, and they'll evaluate it. But there's a saying, and it's well established by now, that a study section won't greenlight a grant to any question it doesn't already know the answer to. So there's this thinking that, well, you know, we have to dot our I's and cross our T's and make sure everything is really good science. But some of those crazy novel ideas that have paid off in the past have been kind of out there, and we're not funding that kind of stuff. So we're really kind of doing more of the same over and over again.
What has happened to some of the big waves of excitement? I mean, targeted therapies a decade ago, and what was a big deal? Where'd that come from? Where'd it go?
Well, we've been through this. If you look through the long lens of history, you can see that we go through these sort of, you know, binge and purges, every 10 years or so. So before, the targeted therapy, the Gleevec molecule, there were several immunotherapy. We're hearing that word again lately. But, we heard about, interferon, which was supposed to be the magic pill and was on the cover of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. Interleukin-2 was another one. We said the same about radiation therapy early in the last century. So we hear this over and over again. And, it's time to step back and evaluate, well, what is it about our systems that aren't really working? When you compare this, our progress to, say, heart disease or so many other, ailments that we have made great progress to, what's different about those than it is in cancer? And that's what I tried to explore in the book.
Is there a problem with the for-profit side of this research, which is very large?
It is large. It's interesting. In interviews with over 10 years with well over 1,000 people in this world, I don't think I found one oncologist, doctor, regulator, anybody, scientist, who wouldn't have given his or her right arm to have found a cure or cures for cancer. Mm-hmm. I think that on an individual level, I did not see greed as a driving force. What I see is, at a corporate level or as an institutional level, academic institutions really want those grants. And so they'll, there's an aggressive way in which they go after them and try to take parts of those grant money through something called indirect. So there is a sort of corporatized greed that comes and affects how we do.
What about on this? The title of your book is The Truth in Small Doses, and it's you go back to a brochure, I think it was in the 1950s, where they say, when you sit down with a patient to talk about cancer, it can be kind of overwhelming. The doctor's best approach is to offer, quoting them here, truth in small doses. You say that those four words lie at the heart of our cancer culture today. What do you mean by that, Cliff?
Well, when you look at – this goes back to the issue of how we're doing, and are we being straightforward in our measures of our progress? So I go and I look at, say, not only the people who are getting the cancer, but let's look at the huge numbers of people dying of cancer. And we measure that through something called age-adjusted death rates, which is a very appropriate statistical tool when you're comparing, say, different groups.
Why is that? Because we have so many more boomers now, so we're going to see more cases, I guess?
Yeah. So, for example, if you were comparing, say, African-American and white incidence of cancer, you'd want to compare them age to age because age is such a huge risk factor for cancer. But if you're looking at the progress over time, you have to understand that America is an aging society. So that is a huge portion. That's a huge part of the reason why we're getting so much more cancer. And so we have to deal with that and be honest about the burden of cancer, which is growing. So you could say the same things also about how we look at survival data or how we look at the number of new drugs that are approved. All of those things are doled out in very, we're only partly honest about how well we're doing. And when you look at the numbers, you get a much scarier story.
Just in the scale of the burden, as you describe it, the numbers of people getting invasive cancer, the number are dying, the burden in pain and dollars of dealing with it. I mean, of course, there are a lot more people aging now, but all the more reason it would have been nice to be further down the road in treating it by this point, Cliff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of it is, when we know what the problem is, then we can organize to solve it. But when we keep saying to ourselves, oh, there's breakthrough after breakthrough or advance or this new discovery after another, we don't have the urgency to change the systems that don't work. And so that really is where our fundamental failure is it's a straightforwardness. I was a Wall Street reporter for a long time. And, when I first started to report this issue on cancer, I'd never done a science story. What struck me were that the financial statements, if you will, the number of people getting the disease and dying of it and what we were spending were very, very different from the rhetoric. And it was very much like the dot-com boom when I started covering, those new internet stocks where companies would use terms like stickiness and eyeballs to describe their progress, but there'd be no revenue. And that's there is that sort of disconnect between the rhetoric and what's really happening on the ground.
I'm going to go in just a minute to a big research chief. A couple of listeners, or let's bring in a couple at this point anyway. Chris in New Orleans is calling. Chris, you're on there with Cliff Leaf. Thanks for calling, Chris. What do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a bit of a disagreement with one of your panelists who suggests that the peer review process is inherently a problem in cancer research. When you think about the amount of money that's being involved in terms of peer review, or in terms of cancer research in general, peer review has to look at incremental increases in terms of cancer approvals. If you decide to try some pie-in-the-sky idea, what you've basically done is taken research away, taking money away from researchers who are doing things that have a much higher rate of success. And secondly, I'd like to say that to actually expect a silver bullet or some type of magic bullet to cure cancer is a bit fanciful, because cancer is not one disease. It's based on genetic mutations, and they expect as many mutations as you could possibly have that might drive cancer. That's how many different solutions you may have to cure any particular tumor.
Chris, you're just terrific on both points. Cliff Leaf will not argue with you for a second on the heterogeneous face of cancer. It has many faces, one silver bullet, too much to ask for. But Cliff Leaf, what about, Chris, on peer review? He says, if you know, you can throw money into fanciful, what's out there on a moonbeam possibilities, you better stay incremental, but be solid.
Yeah, Chris is absolutely right. I mean, you know, but first of all, on both points, the caller is really just dead on both points. The first point is, and I just want to reiterate it, is that, yeah, we absolutely, there will never be probably a single cure for cancer. And it's unlikely that we'll have too many cures for individual cancers. We may have some treatment synergistically that work, but we're going to see very few pure out-and-out cures for cancers that we haven't already gotten. The second issue is this pie-in-the-sky-ness. And I write a lot in depth about that. The problems with peer review is not that we're, say, green lighting, and I use this phrase, a bedsheet flapping at the aurora borealis, but just ideas that don't go right down the straight and narrow. So things that don't follow into what they call hypothesis-driven research. And there are, if you look back at the history of our successes, so many of those ideas came in some ways through just good observations, through really good science, done by very, very smart folks, but not necessarily in the sort of way, in the reductionist way that we look at. So they didn't use the same model systems that we're used to. They were intuitive in some cases. And that's where we've gotten some of our greatest ideas, which I outline in the book. So it's not really, we're not talking about funding crazy ideas. What I outline in The Truth in Small Doses is that the money is going also to the same institutions. It's the same very handful. So, for example, we talk about funding 3,000 research institutions, but basically most of that money goes to just 40. And in fact, more than half of that money goes to the top 100. So we're really not funding outside of our, you know, comfort zone there.
Cliff Leaf, stand by. We're going to hear from very near the top of that pyramid in just a moment here. Here's the thesis. From Cliff Leaf's book. He says, here we go. What's needed to reach the goal of great leaps on cancer is a different sort of political will, a fierce public commitment to undo the incentives, rules, and daily practices that don't work. Many of them are so entrenched it will take an army of citizen scientists and warrior patients to remove them. It will take even more public will to pursue an authentic war on cancer, one that honestly lays out the mission and follows a coordinated plan to achieve it. That sounds like a pretty big indictment of what we're doing right now. On the other hand, everybody wants progress, and there are certainly claims and promising areas on the frontier. I want to look at those right now. Cliff Leaf, please stand by in New York. With me in the studio is Edward Ed Benz. He's president of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. That is right up there in the research world. Professor of medicine, professor of pediatrics, and of genetics at Harvard Medical School. Ed Benz of Dana-Farber, thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I think you know Cliff Leaf's work. He's spent a decade looking into this arena, and he comes out disturbed about the way we're going at it and says we're not on the right track. Where do you agree with him? Where don't you as a big chief in this arena?
Well, you know, there are many things that Mr. Leaf says that I agree with, and I think most of my colleagues would. We find frustration in many of the things that he finds frustrating. I come down somewhat more optimistic about the trajectory of where things are going in the last few years in particular, both with respect to what we're learning about cancer, how we're applying it, and how we're going about supporting it. I think many of the things that he points out that have become what I would call ossified in the system, ways that maybe have worked in a previous era but have become too rigid or too conservative now. I think he's got great points about those. But I've begun to see changes in the way that's doing that. Some of it within the major funder of federal research, which is the National Cancer Institute, in this case for cancer, but the NIH in general, have done a lot of self-examination of the peer review process, have tried to find ways to encourage high-risk, high-reward research to focus much more on potential impact. Recognizing, remember, that you can't predict serendipity and you can't predict innovation. So,
but you can make room for it. Do we make room for it in the current system?
Precisely where I was going with this argument. And a big part of that is we need better ways to provide more support, security, and predictability for the career growth of our younger scientists. Medical training and PhD training is taking longer and longer, so people are already older when they're getting into their training. But the process of getting funded is slower still, so they're very old when they get their first grant, often beyond the age of where the work that many people got for the Nobel Prize was done, that people are older getting funded now than when some people were when they did their Nobel Prize work. So
I mean, that makes perfect sense, but I kind of hear in that, and Cliff, let me bring you in as well. You know, we're looking at career growth here. Cliff Leaf, you describe a kind of careerism getting in the way of breakthrough research. I mean, so where's the emphasis need to be, Cliff?
Yeah, it's really important to stress how hard it is for young investigators today. It is so much harder than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that it's just plain demoralizing. You know, Robert Weinberg, one of the great legendary cancer researchers, was said at a recent cancer meeting, you know, for the first time in 30 years, I would not encourage a young, brilliant person to go into cancer research. He said, I never thought I would ever hear myself say this, but that's how I
feel. That's really distressing. They're the ones most likely to come up with the answer, Ed.
It is.
I Bob Weinberg's good friend and colleague of mine, I violently disagree with his view, and I don't think it is something that should be said publicly, because that will certainly ensure that nobody good comes into it.
But we don't even want that a hint of that in the air, do we? I mean, we want this to, given the scale of this challenge, we need this to be an incredibly inviting arena for bright young minds.
I completely agree, and I think the burden is increasingly on institutions like ours, and I can tell you a few things we're doing to be sure that people of the kind that both Mr. Leaf and I would like to see, not only in the field, but giving their all for a long time in the field, is that we have had to wean ourselves from as much reliance on people getting their first grant, or at least how long it will take them. So we provide now 6 years of salary support for people who we take on as junior faculty. Yes, we encourage them to apply for grants and get them, but they know that that's not going to be the thing that they have to do to keep their jobs, or that they have to change their work just in order to get a grant. We provide them with more startup funds. That means that we have to find other sources, like Stand Up to Cancer, which is trying very hard to fund exactly this kind of approach.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about where we are in tackling cancer with a reporter, editor who says the effort has stalled out, gone awry, and a big research chief who says, no, we are on it. Clifton Leaf is with us, author of The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ed Edward Benz is with us, president of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, a very big wheel in this world. Cliff, a moonshot decade and we could do it. Do what and organized how?
Well, I think that part of that, I don't know that a decade would do it. I pretty much doubt it would. I would think that what we'd want is to just reframe this as an engineering issue rather than a science challenge.
What do you mean
by that?
So
what we did when you first look at the early moonshot, you know, everyone talks about the Apollo program. But if you think about what the Ranger program was before that, which was just to kind of catapult this box onto the moon with all sorts of instruments in it, and it was very, very difficult to do. They thought they had the science. They'd sort of worked out some things. They went launch after launch after launch, and each subsequent failure was more horrifying than the last.
Yep.
Not because they didn't have good science, but because they didn't have good management. And so when they looked at these serial failures, they said, listen, if we can't approach this with good systems management, if we can't get the left side to talk to the right side, left hand to talk to the right hand, we're never going to be able to get there.
Okay.
And that's part of what we do here in cancer. So what I hope to do is say, listen, we have a lot of science, maybe not enough, but a lot that we can fix the systems to get so that we're using common standards, for example. We have multiple reagents that, you know, that we have no standards for them. We have no standard way for testing for certain cancer proteins. We don't have a standard platform for using what's called microarrays, which are these tools that look at the molecular characterization of cells. And so, you know, you use one machine, which have a totally different algorithm than another, and they're not translatable.
So get it organized in a way you're saying.
Yeah.
Get the engineering lined up and just do it. Ed Benz, what about that perspective?
There's, I think, a lot of value in that perspective, although I get a rash when people start talking about moonshots because I think that implies we have a moon to hit. We've already talked about how heterogeneous cancer is within the individual patient as well as among them. And I also think we're in a very different place, and I disagree with Mr. Leaf a little bit here, about how much of the necessary science we really understand, not just know, but understand well enough to apply. But I completely agree with what he's saying about a massive effort to look at the system by which we take the clues that are in our science right now and say, what's the best clues we have and what's the best way to make things better?
Is that not happening?
It happens, but I think Mr. Leaf would agree it happens once in a while, too. I mean, Gleevec is one example. It doesn't happen often enough, and it depends too much on serendipity.
How can that possibly be that with all this effort and years and money and people's, you know, deep commitment to this, that we wouldn't coordinate it fully?
Yeah. It's, you know, I think things grow organically in this country, and I think that's part of it. I think that in many ways, maybe running a little counter to what we were just saying, many of the best opportunities in basic science went unnoticed by the cancer community because they were trying to apply what they did know. The decade of combination chemotherapy and one regimen after another, big focus on clinical trials. Meanwhile, quietly in other labs, maybe not that directly connected to clinical research, basic science was unwinding the tools that allowed us to find out that the root cause of cancer were all these genes that that go bad and mutate. They came together in the 1990s, and now with the Human Genome Project, you know, we are at least able to focus on the root cause. And I think now is a great time for us to say, all right, we know the root cause. We know how complicated things are when those root causes start going wrong. Let's be sure that when the clue comes up that could be applied to therapy, we not only can find it, but we know how to apply it, and the systems are there. It's not the system that's getting in the way. And I think that's where Mr. Leaf and I have complete agreement.
Ed, what's the goal here? If there's no silver bullet, as our caller and you both say, and yet there's a gigantic challenge, and you're talking about some fundamental sort of common ground among these afflictions right here, what is the goal? Is it about treating this cancer as a chronic disease that you just treat the symptoms? Is the goal to find some basic approach to this that allows us to nip it in the bud or to shut it down even after it's begun? What's the goal, Ed?
Yeah, the ultimate goal still has to remain that you could cure these cancers. The realistic goal is that will be true for some, and it will come with time or it will come with a great insight. But for most cancers, recognizing that particularly they occur increasingly in older people with other medical problems, I think that you'll find that the progress over the next couple of decades is better and better ways to hold off the cancer being the cause of your death so that you can live out the rest of your life and in effect, as is often true with people with prostate cancer, die with the cancer, not of it. Even though we can't eradicate it from your body, it will not be something that harms you.
Cliff, I want to get you on this goal, but a couple of callers. Kevin in Olean, New York. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
This is a timely issue for me. Just lost a best friend that I was born with, went to school with just this last Sunday from his cancer.
I'm sorry.
And the last 6 months of his life, it almost seemed like the treatment was worse than the disease was for him. That they were throwing everything they could at it because it was so aggressive and couldn't get a toehold on it, that it seemed like the doctors were focused too much on beating the cancer and not healing the patient.
We hear that story again and again. Kevin, I'm sorry, very sorry for that loss. It's a loss that so many American families and around the world obviously have known. But when it comes close, it's never less painful for them. And I'm sorry for yours. The treatment almost worse than the cure sometimes. And one more in Nashville. Thank you, Kevin. Sympathies to you. Alan in Nashville, you're on.
Thank you, Tom. I've been reminded of a Thoreau quote where he says, there are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil for the one who is striking at the root.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like we're really getting to the root here. I think, and look, cancer is a scourge, and it really does cause a lot of suffering. So I understand the focus on symptoms and the disease once it's taken hold. But it seems to me if we really want to get a grip on this thing, we're going to have to figure out why this rash of cancers is striking us. And it seems to me if it has anything to do with the food, the chemicals on food, or the chemicals in our carpets and our couches and our clothing and our dyes, if we're going to get into that, we're going to get a lot of resistance from the corporate world who sees the lack of profits, because if they're proven, if they have to prove their chemicals are safe, then suddenly they're losing profit. And that seems like a systemic problem that we're fighting against, and I just wonder what your guests have to say about that.
Alan, thank you so much for that. Ed Benz on the root, and the root here that may go to environmental explanations.
Right. We haven't talked as much as, and I know Mr. Leaf has emphasized this in his book correctly, that prevention or detection at the earliest stages is ultimately the best way to be sure you don't die of cancer or suffer from it, and getting there is a real challenge. But I can tell you, if you want to get rid of about a third of cancer deaths worldwide, ban tobacco, ban tanning parlors, use sunscreen.
And okay, there's a third. That's pretty good.
I want to get one very important one that we could be doing now and we're not, speaking of systems,
yes.
is vaccinate everybody against the HPV virus
yes.
that causes cervical cancer. Less of a problem
girls,
in the West,
boys.
But
mm-hmm.
one of the major causes of cancer mortality worldwide. The issue of toxins and food and environmental exposures, I do agree that they're there, but they have been very, very hard to pin down as to what they are and what role they actually play. But toxins
hard
in the environment.
Because, I mean, I want to channel Alan's skepticism. He's saying, well, big industry doesn't want us to look there because we have too much invested in those.
Well, when we've looked, we've had trouble making. I think there, mm-hmm. the problem is that those risks probably are more important to some people than others. Again,
mm-hmm.
this genetic
yes.
Heterogeneity we talked about.
Susceptibility, vulnerability.
Susceptibility.
Mm-hmm.
And a third is that these may increase your risk by one and a half or two or threefold. Those are the kind of numbers. But how many people do you have to study to be able to actually pin that down? And there are bigger studies than it's really feasible to do right now.
Cliff, let me bring this question of the root to you. Our caller
sure.
says, strike at the root. Where is the root? And what would a strike at that look like, Cliff?
Well, this gets back to the issue, excuse me, of cancer as a process, not as a disease or state of being. And this is what we really have to fundamentally think of it as, like heart disease, at least in this one respect. We know that You know, we don't say that heart disease starts with the heart attack on the golf course or at the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles. We say, you know, okay, it's a long, dynamic, evolving process, and we look for symptoms, we look for biomarkers along the way. So hypertension, high cholesterol, all of these things that we can look at and say, this is a process, and we can intervene in that process. And through that strategy, we've had one of the most successful interventions in public health of all time. We've reduced the death rates from heart disease in the last 50 years by 60%. I mean, in raw numbers, there are fewer people dying of heart disease today than there were in 1970, even though we have 100 million more people in the country. So we don't
what
do
would
that
perspective,
with
what would that perspective mean for cancer? How would you apply that perspective?
Well, Dr. Benz hit on one with HPV vaccines. So, for example, we know that certain strains of HPV increase the likelihood of causing cancers to develop in the cervix, in the uterine cervix. And so that's one very clear way where we can take a vaccine, which is a lot of bang for the buck. We also didn't talk enough about colonoscopies. Dr. LaPook at the beginning of the hour had talked about this. You know, if you want to talk about, you know, great successes in cancer, you know, it's not coming from medicines with colorectal cancer.
That's screening.
There's no new medicine. It's finding those pre-invasive lesions, those pre-neoplastic lesions called polyps that, you know, you can remove in a colonoscopy and they can't become a cancer.
But it seems too much to ask to catch everything up front. I mean, some people can take that vaccine and that may work. Some will have a colonoscopy, find the polyp, good for them. But for those who don't, hang on a second, Cliff. Michael in Lexington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just calling with regard to the comment that was made earlier about there not being any standardization in terms of analytical tools and you mentioned microarrays in particular. I am a computer scientist. I work in the biomedical field, and I analyze microarrays probably every day, and I just wanted to mention that one of the reasons there's no standardization of sort of the analytical tools and other things that are used is partly because of the competitive model of funding that we're under, where there's a lot of motivation to share your results, but a lot less motivation to put any effort into sharing and standardizing tools. And that's true in academia as well, and even more so in industry, I think.
So competitive, not from a profit angle necessarily, but for a grant application perspective, Michael.
That's right. It's all about getting sort of publications and then getting the grant funding off of that. There isn't really so much funding and motivation for standard tools.
Yeah, Cliff, competition's great, but there's a medical researcher saying, you know, we get too locked in silos of competition.
Absolutely. Michael is right on. That's exactly right. And all these things are related because, well, you know, when we're looking for those early markers of disease, we really need tumor specimens, for example. Here's a great example of the failure to share or to have any kind of standards. There, despite the fact that we've got nearly 1.7 million Americans being diagnosed with a cancer each year, researchers have a shortage of tumor specimens. They can't find enough of these things to look and to find those, you know, to investigate those cells and those tumors.
Seems
to figure
unbelievable.
Out. Yeah. And so when you go and look at why that's the case, it's because of this, you know, there's some hoarding of the tissue that's come. There's no standardization in terms no standard procedures for retrieving that tissue, for cataloging, you know, the histories of those cells, for getting patient information, for getting the privacy releases, all those things. You would think that we'd be able to network this. And the effort that the NCI has tried in many years has basically had there's no critical mass. If you compare that to what we've done, say, with eBay or with Amazon.com, it's staggering, the disconnect.
Ed Benz, how do we cut through here? Cliff Leaf writes, he says, the research culture has been ever more shaped by the frenzy of grantsmanship, publication, and bureaucracy. It's become ever more fearful of risk-taking. It's lost its collective sense of urgency to solve the cancer problem. We must find it again. How much of that do you agree with? How do we do it?
Well, I think there's things to agree with there, but once again, maybe the reason I have a bit more optimism mm-hmm. about the future is I get to see what places like ours and some of the other institutions that we're increasingly collaborating with are beginning to do. I think one important point to make is mm-hmm. if we wait for a federal agency to turn this around, we'll be waiting a long time.
Don't wait.
It's a federal agency, and they're trying to do their best. But I think we need to look at what's going out closer to the grassroots. We are one, Dana-Farber, and all the Harvard hospitals, among hundreds of institutions that have just signed an agreement to do exactly what both the caller, Mr. Leaf, said we were going to do. Shared tissue, shared data mm-hmm. before publication, create a pre-competitive space. Our young investigators are a big hope here. Jay Bradner is one of our young faculty, has discovered incredibly novel molecules that studying a very rare form of cancer, but have potential to be much more broadly applicable. He's open source. He's finding out other uses and better tweaks on this molecule, a way to make a better mousetrap out of that molecule by crowdsourcing, by using electronic means. I think these are the things that are beginning to catch on, and I think it goes back to the need for young investigators because they're the ones that are going to force us to change.
Young investigators, come on in. We need you, and we need you badly. Cliff Leaf, do you see the ship turning in the direction you're hoping?
I hope so. I'm very optimistic, actually, about the ability of people to have change when they want it.
Well, we want it. Let's have it. Cliff Leaf is author of The Truth in Small Doses. Cliff, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Ed Benz, president of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. We can only wish you the very best in your work. Certainly there are a lot of people who are counting on you and many others. If there are walls, break them down, Ed. We need you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. We're going to do everything we can to merit that trust.
We appreciate that. Go get it. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.